we have an incredible opportunity to grow in providing broadband and IT solutions to businesses.
ACS sells its cell phone service to GCI. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, recent vandalism prompts a tough choice at an Anchorage cathedral.
The last thing that we would want to do is to not have the cathedral open. So, you know, it's a discussion that we're having.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
General Communications Incorporated, or GCI, will purchase Alaska Communications' cell phone customer base. The $300 million purchase should be finalized by the end of March. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
GCI Vice President David Morris says the companies are working to ensure a smooth transition. And once the deal is complete, ACS plans will remain largely intact, at least for now.
We have contracted with ACS to help transition the ACS customers moving on over to the GCI billing system. Alaska Communications has a specific billing system, so we will need to take that and modify it for our back office systems and, of course, train personnel to use that system, learn the rates or the plans of Alaska Communications.
The purchase also includes ACS's share of the Alaska Wireless Network. The network was formed in July 2013 and combined the wireless network assets of both companies in order to expand coverage and compete with national carriers. Though the partnership did work, Moore says there were a number of inefficiencies which he believes this purchase will help smooth out.
By pulling this solely within GCI, it should allow us to more quickly make network decisions, technology decisions, and certainly reduce the amount of accounting and back office tracking that was necessary.
Because customers of both companies have been on essentially the same network for the last year and a half, Morris says changes in service should be minimal. Heather Cavanaugh is the Director of Corporate Communications at ACS. She says the money from the sale will go toward paying down the company's debt, which totals around $415 million. And it will allow ACS to focus its resources on other services.
We have an incredible opportunity to grow in providing broadband and IT solutions to businesses. And in fact, this is an area where we've been growing steadily for almost the past 3 years now. And we have one of the highest growth rates in this area in our sector compared to other telecommunications companies our size.
Approximately 109,000 ACS customers will be affected by the purchase. ACS will continue to provide cellular service to customers until the purchase is finalized. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
An historic Anchorage landmark has been vandalized, and police are saying little about the incident. Late Tuesday afternoon, Anchorage police were contacted by a staffer at the Holy Family Cathedral regarding a burglary and vandalism that had taken place at the church that day. Police say the vandals overturned pews and the pulpit and other furniture, broke statues, and ripped out part of the church's audio system. It does not appear that there was forced entry into the church. Father Stephen Moore with the Archdiocese of Anchorage says the vandalism appears to be random.
The police are still investigating, but it appears to be more an act of just kind of random, violent vandalism than it does. It does not seem to be motivated by particularly any anti-religious sentiment, at least that we can discern at this point.
He says he is not aware that anything was stolen. The vandalism highlights a concern by church officials regarding the policy of leaving church doors unlocked during the day. Moore says it's a challenge balancing the open door policy with risk to church property. Father Moore says that any decision to change that policy is up to the staff at the cathedral.
I think everybody would say that the last option that we would pursue or the last thing that we would want to do is to not have the cathedral open or to restrict the opening of the cathedral. So, you know, it's a discussion that we're having.
Father Moore says, however, he is getting positive feedback from the community.
There's been a real sort of outpouring of concern and an outpouring of people who appreciate the presence of the cathedral, the presence of the Dominicans downtown, what they're doing, and really are concerned about it. And it was coming from people from all kinds of faiths and from no particular faith. They were just concerned and upset. And that's been really a real encouraging thing.
Holy Family Cathedral is the first church built in Anchorage and will mark its 100th anniversary next year. The church was built in 1915 at the request of railroad workers. The landmark building once hosted Pope John Paul II during his historic visit to Alaska in 1981. State Department of Environmental Conservation officials have been in Fairbanks this week sharing information and taking public feedback on a plan for getting the area into compliance with federal air quality standards. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The state plan focuses on reducing smoke from wood burning, which has been shown to be the primary source of fine particulate levels that often exceed federal standards during the winter. One of the proposed regulations would implement increasingly strict limits on visible emissions from chimneys as air quality degrades. Wood stove manufacturer Blaze King Industries Vice President Chris Neufeld was involved in development of the plan and considers smoke opacity regulation the best way to reduce pollution.
Opacity doesn't allow people to come into your home and look and see what you're doing. It just says what's coming out of your stack is not good for the environment, and we want to help you get around that, meaning the state or the borough.
Many North Star Borough residents have benefited from a subsidy program to upgrade to new stoves. Local wood stove dealer Kent Severn says it's disappointing to see stoves capable of low emissions putting out a lot of smoke.
When people commit to burning wood, I think they need to commit to the lifestyle and make sure they're burning properly.
Severance also favors the opacity regulations in the state plan as the best way to enforce clean wood burning. The plan goes further by limiting new stoves to models with a specific EPA emissions rating and requiring wood sellers to disclose wood moisture content. The state plan is aimed at getting Fairbanks into compliance as soon as possible, but officials realistically expect that won't happen until 2019, when a project to bring affordable natural gas to Fairbanks reaches enough residents to encourage a switch to the cleaner burning heat source. At a Department of Environmental Conservation public hearing Wednesday, Fairbanks resident Owen Hanley suggested offering subsidized propane to get high emissions wood boiler operators to more immediately switch to gas.
I think it would be a win-win that those 400 or so wood boiler burners would now have the cheapest source of heat in Fairbanks. And the 99,000 of the rest of us would have clean air.
That would require funding from the state of Alaska. State Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole supports an even broader fuel subsidy effort targeting wood burners with backup oil-fired systems.
They need to make sure that we have oil that we can afford if they want us to shut down, you know, burning wood.
An unfunded subsidy program won't immediately make it into the state plan, which is due to the Environmental Protection Agency by the end of the month. But the DEC's Cindy Heil says the agency is working to incorporate public comment on its regulations and make the EPA deadline.
We're taking notes during the hearings. We're jotting down everything everybody tells us at the open houses. We have a lot of items coming in online, and so we are working those issues as we go.
Heil stresses that the plan will be a living document that can be updated with new emissions reduction programs after it's filed with the EPA. Final hearings on the air quality improvement plan are scheduled for Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau on December 17th. Public comment closes on the 19th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks student is dead, the apparent victim of an accident. UAF spokeswoman Miriam Grimes says the body of the 48-year-old male student was found on a campus parking lot this morning.
Police received a call shortly after 8 o'clock this morning. Someone was parked in the Reichart parking lot and saw a man on the ground outside a vehicle there. They responded, and the man was deceased. It appears to be an accidental and self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Grimes says the student's name and hometown are being withheld until next of kin has been notified. She stresses the investigation is just beginning. UAF counseling is available to help members of the university community. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, musher Karen Hendrickson bows out of the Iditarod to focus on her recovery
And I just have to be really careful and not doing jarring or jumping around, which means pretty much no dogs for quite a good long while.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Winter is a time to focus on home and family, a time for eating good food and telling stories. This season, the Salmon Project is thankful to be sharing Alaskan salmon stories from around the state. The Salmon Project celebrates Alaskans' deep personal relationships with salmon as food, a source of pride, a way of life, and as the focus of a lot of fun. To read Alaskan stories or share your own, visit salmonproject.org/story. Salmon, it runs deep in all of us. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Alaska's new attorney general says he will view litigation over same-sex marriage in the state strictly along constitutional lines. Craig Richards also says he will review issues related to the Alaska National Guard, including ensuring that proper prosecutions were brought for wrongful behavior and the release of public records by former Governor Sean Parnell's administration were done diligently. Richards is the former law partner of Governor Bill Walker, who took office Monday. Walker announced Richards as his pick for attorney general last week. Richards says that as a law nerd, there couldn't be a more fun job. He says it's a great opportunity. The appointment must be approved by lawmakers. Alaska's top military commander, Lieutenant General Russell Handy, has been on the job here for more than a year. He's overseeing ALCOM at a time when the U.S. relationship with Russia has been frosty. In September, Russian military flights that were within 50 miles of the Alaskan and Canadian coastlines caused enough concern that J-Bear sent F-22s to intercept them. Lieutenant General Handy says the Russian flights did not cross into the 12-mile international boundary zone and were not considered hostile.
A hostile aircraft has to demonstrate some sort of clear intent to do harm. And so there's a, as I say, without going into specifics, there's a very disciplined set of rules that we go by before we would declare someone hostile. You mentioned penetrating an international boundary 12 miles. You know, that in and of itself perhaps may not indicate a hostile aircraft, but it may be one ingredient in that calculus. To date, these aircraft have been in international airspace, in our identification zone, certainly, but in international airspace, and frankly, have behaved very professionally.
Last year at this time when you came in, we talked about Secretary Hagel's Arctic Strategy Plan. There were eight main points, and the highest priority was protecting U.S. sovereignty in the Arctic. Last year, you said the Arctic was not seen as an area of high threat, but things have changed considerably with the nation's relationship with Russia. Is there a greater concern or emphasis on U.S. Arctic security now? Is that being looked at anew?
I will say that since we talked last, the attention is greater. And I don't think it's because of a change in the evolution of the Arctic, but it's because of a lot of great dialogue and a lot of leaders understanding the importance of the Arctic. I think what we are seeing is fairly universal agreement that climate change is having an impact on the Arctic. It is. We're seeing fairly clear agreement that there will be a greater freedom of navigation in the Arctic. And with that comes a greater ability to harness riches in the Arctic, for example, oil and gas, a great degree of unexplored oil and gas in the Arctic. And whenever you get into that sort of a situation, nations and nation states are going to potentially want to have a part of that, and there's always potential for friction in that. It's the largest approach to our homeland. If you look at the border of Alaska, and if you combine that with Canada, it's a huge challenge to be able to have situational awareness across all of that.
There's been a lot of talk about budget constraints and funding cuts. Are you being told that there may be more cuts coming for Alaska's military? And specifically the budget cuts that were mandated by the sequester in 2011?
It's a good time to ask the question. I think that we perhaps will see more realignments. I think we've heard from an Air Force perspective, we've heard the Secretary and the Chief say that they feel that we're about as low as we can go. However, through fiscal year 15, we have some stability. But I will tell you, unless we get new legislation and the Budget Control Act kicks in fiscal 16 again, we are sort of right back where we started from. And so I don't think you'd find anyone in a leadership position in the DOD that would disagree that we need to not have that happen again. It was destructive. The budget wasn't predictable. We lost faith with our civilian workforce by laying them off, if you will. We shut down our entire operation and we canceled very, very important activities, very, very important training activities that had an impact for a number of years.
Will the Air Force and Alaska Command be assisting the Coast Guard and the Navy farther away at sea as things open in the Arctic?
That's certainly very possible. As you know, the Navy has no permanent basing in Alaska, so they're up here exercising and they have a lot of activities, but to date have not, you know, stood up any bases. The deep water port study that you've heard some talk about on the West Coast, you know, where that port may be, is a very popular topic with the Navy as well as the Coast Guard. So I believe the answer to that is yes. We already partner very closely with the Coast Guard when we exercise and simulate large contingency operations, whether they be sort of a military threat based or a disaster based, natural disaster based. The Navy plays robustly, and they are directly tied in to our headquarters here, Alaskan Command.
Lieutenant General Russell Handy is the commander of Alaska's military. The herring spawn on kelp fishery in Hoonah Sound will remain closed in the 2015 season for the second year in a row. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced the closure this week. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Hoonah Sound spawn on kelp fishery is a different animal than its cousin 50 miles to the south, the Sitka Sound Sac Roe herring fishery. The main difference is that the fish survive in Hoonah and only their eggs are harvested. Nevertheless, assistant management biologist Eric Kuhnrat says there just aren't enough herring to risk it.
You know, we saw eggs on the beach in 2012, and the fish didn't materialize for 2013, so it's hard to say, but there's something that's killing fish or not allowing fish to come back.
The forecast calls for 721 tons of herring to return to Hoonah Sound, about 280 tons below the threshold needed to harvest eggs. And it's a fraction of the fish that have been known to come back to the area. Kuhnrat says ADF&G has recorded returns as high as 20,000 tons. As a biologist, Kuhnrat is reluctant to guess what's causing the low returns, but he's pretty sure it's natural, possibly a disease event associated with the huge returns of just a few years ago.
Usually these disease events hit one end of the age group or another, but in this case, it seemed to hit all age groups fairly equally. So that kind of puts a question mark into what happened, you know, whether they're spawning elsewhere or if it was a significant die-off.
There are 109 permit holders in the Hoonah Sound spawn-on kelp fishery. The economic impact of the closure is hard to pin down since it's a niche product. The same permit covers Tenneke Inlet, which remained open last year, though volumes of herring there are typically smaller than in Hoonah. Still, it's going to sting. According to Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission data, spawn-on kelp permits have nearly doubled in value over the last 8 years and now go for around $35,000. There's even been a slight uptick in permit value over the last year when the fishery was first shut down. Kuhnrat says that under the right conditions, herring can rebound quickly.
If we have a good ocean survival of larvae and juvenile, in 1 year we can see a huge increase in the biomass. That used to be the case for Sitka Sound. You know, you'd have one big year class that would kind of carry it for a couple of years. And, you know, we very well could see that with Hoonah Sound. You know, we haven't seen it in a while, so we've seen this steady recruitment, but one good survival event of juveniles could bring this fishery back.
The Hoonah Sound and Sitka Sound herring stocks are genetically related, but Kuhnrat says they're treated as separate populations. Swings in biomass in one area may not necessarily be reflected in the other. Still, ADF&G is forecasting one of the lowest herring returns in years in Sitka too, and there's been political pressure from the Sitka tribe and others to dramatically curb sac roe fishing. Hoonah is the less controversial fishery, and Kuhnrat is hoping the closure does its job.
I think it's concerning. Our limitations are to prevent any, you know, further harvest on the resource. And we've done that. We've closed the fishery, and the fishery won't reopen until, you know, the population reaches threshold. And I think we are where we are, and there's not much more we can do about it at this point in time.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Plans to turn an old bar into a way to raise money for emergency housing in Unalaska are slowing down. That's after the city discovered that the nonprofit Alexandria House had worked on the project all year without a building permit. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
The old Elbow Room has gotten a major makeover since Pastor John Honan started working on it earlier this year. He's had volunteers install new floorboards, wall frames, and windows, and there's still more to do.
So I need my sliding glass door. I've got that ordered. That has to go in. The siding has to be completed. The roof is mostly done.
When it's all finished, he'll rent it out as an apartment and commercial space. The revenue will help Alexandria House shelter sober, stranded people in hotels and spare rooms all over town. Unalaska's planning board approved the project about a year ago. They gave Honan a conditional use permit, which he thought was all he needed to start building. But he was supposed to apply for an actual building permit, too. City engineer Robert Lund says it was part of the conditional use.
The point of that is to kind of get things to a point where the owner's been formally notified and that they can say, well, no, I'm just doing siding or roofing. Do I need a permit for that? But it gives us a chance to evaluate that.
But Lund doesn't go out looking for projects that might not have proper permits. The Elbow Room was on his radar, but he didn't know until this summer that Honan had missed a step.
I got an email that from someone that said, I think they're doing more than they said they were going to do, something along those lines. So I call that a complaint.
He told Honan to stop work and apply for the building permit, which Honan did. But the plans he submitted weren't what the city was expecting. The conditional use had limited the apartment to the second floor, a holdover from a previous owner that wasn't revised. This year, though, Honan's been building what he says is another bedroom in the back of the ground floor beside the Arctic entry leading upstairs. He says he still sees the apartment as one single family unit, but the city isn't so sure. Lund says the plans don't make it clear whether the downstairs chunk constitutes a separate dwelling.
If you were looking at that and it's clearly the bottom floor is clearly an apartment or really meant for living quarters, soup kitchen, that kind of thing, then that I don't think that that would kind of follow in the spirit of what the planning department thought they were given a permit for.
Lund's talking about what he calls the controversial aspect of this project. 5 years ago, John Honan asked if he could build a homeless shelter in the Elbow Room. Neighbors and the city said no. This time, it'll be up to whoever lives in the new apartment to decide whether to take in guests for Alexandria House. Barring a nuisance complaint, nothing in city code prohibits that. So neighbors are still concerned, and the city says Honan will have to go through another public permitting process if he wants to move ahead with the two-floor plan. Honan's not sure it's worth the risk.
If there was an article that came out and said, Alexandria House is going for another conditional use, I don't know what would happen. I'm thinking it could make more restrictions, maybe.
His other option is to scrap the downstairs bedroom and get a building permit for the commercial space and apartment as originally planned. As of now, he hasn't decided what to do. He's busy buttoning up the Elbow Room for the winter. The city's letting him do things like seal the roof and walls through the end of the year.
So the good news is I've got my hands full of work to do.
Come January, though, that permission expires, and Honan will have to pick a plan in order to move forward. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Iditarod musher Karen Hendrickson is on the road to recovery. She will miss the 2015 race, but her dogs will not. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Last week, Karen Hendrickson was injured in an accident that epitomizes being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
She was on a training run with her dog team and a four-wheeler on the side of the park's highway when a vehicle lost control on the icy road and struck her. Hendrickson suffered 3 broken vertebrae and an injury to her leg. She counts herself lucky, given the circumstances.
You know, it's pretty incredible because people usually don't get hit by cars and walk away from it, and I didn't walk away, but I'm doing really well.
Karin Hendrickson is beginning inpatient therapy, which will be followed by more physical therapy after she's released. She says that her injuries will prevent her from continuing to train for the 2015 Iditarod.
And I just have to be really careful and not do any jarring or jumping around, which means pretty much no dogs, for quite a good long while.
Like many mushers, Karin Hendrickson is as concerned, if not more so, for her team than herself in some regards. She didn't like the idea of her dogs missing this year's race.
I thought about these dogs. What they love to do is run. What they love to do is go out and race and experience new things. They really do love it. And I just felt horrible to have them spend an entire year where they weren't going to be able to do those things.
That's where Brian Bears comes in. He's a friend of Hendrickson's and a veteran of the 2006 Iditarod.
I'm compacting 12 months of planning, preparation, and now fundraising into a three-month period.
Bears says he's been training for a canoe marathon, so has been keeping himself in good physical shape. For the planning and training side, he says he'll rely on the work that Karin Hendrickson has already done.
It's just going to be able to sit down with Karin and really look at the schedule that she set up for her dogs. This is her race. All I'm going to do is be the jockey.
After the planning will come the actual runs with the dogs. Since Brian Bears has a full-time job during the week, his ability to run the dogs is limited to weekends.
Every Friday night after I finish work here in the Anchorage School District, I'm going to be hopping in the car with my two dogs and driving up to Talkeetna and putting in some long runs Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, and then racing back to Anchorage so I'm ready for work on Monday.
While she won't be able to compete in the 2015 Iditarod, Karin Hendrickson says she doesn't think her mushing days are over.
I got a lot of healing to do, but I think I'll be back next year.
In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Aldrin. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.